We'll call the fourth case on our docket today, United States v. Black. This is 20-3199, and we'll hear from Mr. Hensmeyer.
Good Bacharach, may it please the court. This case is about the Speedy Trial Act, and specifically when the statutory speedy trial clock starts under the unique facts of this case. The relevant provision is Section 3161C1. That provision provides that in any case in which a not guilty plea is entered, the statutory speedy trial clock starts when a defendant, quote, has appeared before a judicial officer of the court in which such charge is pending, end quote. Here, Mr. Black first appeared before a federal magistrate judge in the Western District of Missouri on April 30th, 2018, at which time he entered a not guilty plea to the charges pending in that court. Under 3161C1's plain text, the Act's protections were triggered on that date. Now, the district court held otherwise because the case had been transferred to Missouri from Kansas via Rule 20, but that fact is irrelevant under 3161C1's text. While Congress could have started the speedy trial clock when a defendant has appeared before a judicial officer of the court in which such charge is pending for trial, did not. That two-word phrase, for trial, is not found within 3161C1, although Congress included the phrase in other provisions within the Speedy Trial Act. And the Speedy Trial Act expressly addresses delays associated with Rule 20 transfers in 3161H1E, not 3161C1. Judge Phillips, you got a question?
You're on mute. Judge Phillips.
Did the indictment remain pending in Kansas?
I don't think it did, no.
You don't think the indictment remained pending in Kansas, even?
Not after it's transferred, no.
Well, was the original indictment still housed in Kansas?
It would have been transferred to Missouri via Rule 20.
Well, your understanding is that the entire court file, including the original indictment, was sent to Missouri?
I mean, I don't know. Are you talking about like physically moved?
Yes.
Well, I mean, in this electronic day and age, I assume it exists in both places. I'm not entirely.
Well, did the prosecution have to re-indict when the case went back to Kansas?
No, Rule 20 provides for the proceedings that it be restored to the docket. So it's just a, you know, paper trail, I guess. It moves from one court to the other. I actually think Rule 20 helps us on this. If we look at subsection A on Rule 20, it correctly identifies the charging district as the district where the indictment is pending prior to the transfer. If you look at subsection B, it does the same. It correctly identifies the charging district as the district where the indictment is pending just prior to the transfer. But when you get to subsection C, after the transfer, the rule refers to the charging district as, quote, the court where the prosecution began. Now, if that charging district was still the court where the indictment is pending, there's no reason for the change in language. So just to sort of build on that answer I just gave you, I think the answer I gave you is plainly supported by the text of Rule 20. So just picking up where I was at, I mean, I think all of this makes this an easy case. The district court should have dismissed the indictment under the Speedy Trial Act. Because it did not, this court should vacate and remand for the district court to determine whether to dismiss the indictment with or without prejudice. You know, the government makes claims based on text, context, purpose, and precedent. And then there's also an alternate ground, which we don't think this court should address. Happy to address any of this. So if we start with text, I think our position is pretty plain. The government's position isn't faithful to the text. It's a plea to this court to add words, the phrase for trial, to 3161C1's text. That plea should fall on deaf ears. Supreme Court just reminded us this court may not narrow a provision's reach by inserting words Congress chose to omit. Government's contextual argument looks to only at one other provision within the Speedy Trial Act, 3161A, but that provision doesn't help the government. While Congress used the phrase for trial twice within that provision, it omitted the phrase within Section 3161C1. And courts are, quote, doubly careful to avoid reading words into statutes where Congress has shown that it knows how to adopt the omitted language, end quote. And again, we have Section H1E, the provision that expressly deals with Rule 20 transfers. That provides more context here than 3161A. There's no reason to interpret 3161C1 atextually to deal with a Rule 20 transfer that is expressly dealt with in another provision within the Act. Government cites the Act's title. I think we've explained that it's our position that produces a speedier trial, not the government's position. To the extent the government talks about efficient administration of justice, that's a, at most, tertiary purpose that is tied to other provisions within the Act, not 3161C1. I don't really know what we want to talk about. Any questions?
Seymour, do you have any questions?
I have a question. I was muted, so I had to unmute it. If we accept your position, what is to stop future defendants from using Rule 20 transfers in bad faith in order to trigger the Speedy Trial Act clock?
Well, the Speedy Trial Act is going to prevent that in multiple ways, and courts can as well. I think one thing that we can talk about is a typical Rule 20 transfer. A typical Rule 20 transfer, the defendant isn't arraigned in the transfer district. The initial appearance, the first time the defendant appears in the court, in the transferee district, he pleads guilty. So the unique facts here are really why we're here. The Western District of Missouri, they had an arraignment. Mr. Black pleaded not guilty. That is the statutory trigger under the clock. In most cases, that's not going to happen. The defendant's going to plead guilty when he initially appears in the transferee district, and we're not going to have this situation. Top of that, if this situation arises again, it's simple. The government can move for an ends of justice continuance if they can't get the defendant back when they want to get the defendant back. The court can do it on its own. So that would be the proper procedure. And again, H1E is going to exclude most of this time anyway, until the defendant, until the transfer proceedings end. And that gives everyone plenty of time to figure out what to do as far as the Speedy Trial Act. And I mean, look, I don't think it's true that Mr. Black subjectively intended any of this. I think he was in good faith, thought, let's get all of this settled in Missouri. It didn't work out. And, this is something that is baked into Rule 20C. Sometimes it doesn't work out. We've been talking a lot about plea agreements as contracts this morning. This is no different. Plea agreement is a contract. Two parties have to come together to agree on terms. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes it's not the defendant's fault. Sometimes it's government's. Sometimes it's nobody's fault. If you can't agree, you can't agree. And Rule 20 says, if you can't agree, then we send the case back. So I really think this is a one-off case. I don't think we'll ever see it again. It's an issue of first impression that I don't think any court has ever seen. And the Speedy Trial Act is, 50 years old now? So I do think it's a one-off. I don't think there's any sort of consequences from a decision for Mr. Black that is going to affect anything moving forward, other than, this court saying what the text says. And I think that's always important. I can talk about the precedent if we're concerned about creating a circuit split.
Let me back up and just make sure that we've covered where the indictment's pending. What's your authority for saying that the indictment no longer was pending in Kansas because of the Rule 20 proceeding?
The authority, so I can walk through Rule 20A again. So if you look at Rule 20, if you look at subsection A, it refers to the transferee court as the district where the indictment is pending.
Is pending, and there's nothing that ever says was pending.
But there is. So if you go down to Rule 20C, this is after the transfer. then the rule refers to the charging district as, quote, the court where the prosecution began.
Yeah, it doesn't say was pending, my point.
But the only,
only time it talks about pending is in the present tense.
But it uses the past tense began. So it's referring to the charging district as the former district. And look, it's real simple. If it's still impending, if the indictment is still pending in the transferee district, then that language doesn't change. There's no point of the rules drafters changing the language from the district where the indictment is pending to the court where the prosecution began. That change, no point in it.
Well, there's a difference between an indictment pending and a prosecution. Do you agree with that or not? Prosecution is all kinds of hearings and events and witnesses. And an indictment and a charge are a piece of paper.
Correct.
And so if the indictment is still pending in Kansas and the Speedy Trial Act, the C1 refers to the court in which such charge is pending, that would suggest to me that the charge and the indictment are cemented in Kansas. And that, sure, you can have these other proceedings in another jurisdiction just for convenience's sake, but that case always belongs to Kansas. That charge does, that indictment does. And if that's true, then it's simple the other way.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's true. I don't think you can read the provisions to say that. I think on the ground, when a case is transferred from Kansas to Missouri to be disposed of, the Kansas court, you know, convicts the person, sentences the person, enters, or the Missouri court convicts the person, sentences the person, enters judgment against the person.
Doesn't try the person, though. Can't have a trial.
You can have a trial. Well,
what about the Sixth Amendment?
The Sixth Amendment.
Yeah, as far as where you're allowed to be tried.
That's a constitutional right, not a jurisdictional right. It can be waived. So a Rule 21 transfer. I mean, here's the problem with the way in which it would work under your world. If this transfer happened and the parties then agreed to a Rule 21 waiver of jurisdiction or of venue, and the case is tried in Missouri, and the defendant is convicted in Missouri, sentenced in Missouri, judgment entered in Missouri. To say that the most natural reading of that language is that indictment is still pending in Kansas, we just think that is not the most natural reading. And again, if Congress meant that, it would have simply included the phrase for trial after the word pending. So I think on the ground, when a case is transferred from Kansas to Missouri, it is given a Western District of Missouri case number. So the charges are pending there. Venue can be waived. It's a Western District of Missouri case until it's not. And here, when it's a Western District of Missouri case, he pleads guilty. He's arraigned on April 30th, 2018, before a judicial officer in which the charge is pending. Plain language, clock starts. Everything after that can be dealt with under the exclusions in subsection H. And with that, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay. Karen, let's stop Mr. Hansmeier's clock. So we're not eating into your rebuttal. Judge Phillips, do you have any follow-up questions?
I don't, thank you.
Judge Seymour, do you?
No, I'll wait.
Okay, Ms. Rao.
May it please the court, Sangeeta Rao on behalf of the United States. The district court here correctly interpreted section 3161C as starting the speedy trial clock when defendant appeared before the Kansas court. It's an interpretation in line with three other courts of appeals showing this is not a one-off situation. The district court's interpretation is consistent with the statute's text and context. Under subsection C, the clock runs from the date the defendant has appeared before the court in which such charge is pending. The Kansas court fits within the plain meaning of that phrase, with no other words added. It is the court in which such charge is pending. Because
right. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I have a question, but I want you to finish.
It was just always the court, the only court that ever had the authority to take the defendant to trial in this case, where there was only a Rule 20 waiver, so not a Rule 21 waiver of venue. So the charges always remained pending in Kansas.
Okay, that's what I want to probe a little bit. And Mr. Hansmeier is talking about Rule 20, And Rule 20C says if a defendant pleads not guilty after the case has been transferred under Rule 20A, the clerk must return to the papers to the court, which suggests to me that the papers, including the indictment, or at least theoretically or pre-ECF, would have actually gone from Kansas to Missouri. And then it says, uses the past tense, where the prosecution began. And that court, the originating court where the prosecution began, it says, quote, must restore the proceedings to its docket. So as I read Rule 20C, the proceedings had been physically and meaningfully taken away from the docket in the District of Kansas while it had been transferred, given a new case number, as Mr. Hansmeier mentions, in Missouri. How is your argument to be compatible with Rule 20C?
Well, the Missouri court only had a very small portion of the case. It only had the limited authority to take a guilty plea and sentence. It could never set the case for trial.
Could he have pleaded guilty after the case had been transferred under Rule 20A? Could the district court in Kansas have taken a plea or done anything?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that it could have done. It could have acted while the case was had limited transfer authority. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't pending in Kansas. It still remained pending in Kansas.
Well, okay. But in any event, you are conceding that on the day that he pleaded not guilty in the District of Missouri, the only court in the federal court in the United States that could have done anything with the defendant was the District of Missouri. The district in Kansas legally could not do anything.
Well, yeah, under Rule 20, I think that what that shows is that. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do you agree with what I just said?
Yes, I think just that the way Rule 20 works, both two courts can't be prosecuting the defendant at the same time. And but so the fact that
definite article in 3161 that you're referring to, the court in which the defendant appears, well, that's not what it says. The date the defendant appeared before a judicial officer of the court in which such charge is pending, the only court in the United States, at least if we decide that in which the charge is pending is coextensive with the only court in the United States that had power to act, was the District of Missouri, right?
I think what Your Honor's question is getting at is that there can be two courts in which the charge is pending in some sense. So the charge is always pending in Kansas for trial because that is the only court that could ever take it to trial on the facts of this case. The case is also pending in Kansas. In some manner, some small part of the case is pending in Kansas. But so the question then is, what does the language of 3161C mean? It is directed at the singular court. And it's all about, the entire 3161C is about setting a case for trial. It's about when the speedy trial clock commences. If this court has to decide, what is the singular court that Congress intended when it used that language, the best reading is the Kansas court.
The Kansas court sits within Missouri. When he pleaded not guilty in Missouri, could the district court in Missouri have set it for trial in the District of Kansas?
No.
Let me ask you about my experience as a magistrate judge, because magistrate judges in the United States do this every single day of the week. So when I would have an initial appearance on a defendant that was charged in another district, and I conduct a Rule 20 proceeding, and I release that defendant, and say he is in the Western District of Texas, my courtroom deputy contacts the courtroom deputy in the Western District of Texas, gets a date for that defendant, not necessarily to have trial, but for a date to appear in the Western District of Texas. And so I will say, Defendant X, you were to appear in the Western District of Texas at 9:00 in the morning on January the 8th, 2030. And so I don't understand why a judge in Missouri is incapable, if the judge is able to speak, to say, you're to appear in the District of Kansas before Judge Belgren for trial on the docket of January the 8th, 2030. I mean, it's not hard. I mean, you can do that.
I do think it's different, Your Honor. Appearing in another district, for example, is contemplated by Rule 20. So Rule 20 grants that authority for a court to transfer an appearance to plead guilty, but it does not transfer the authority for a trial. So this court still has to decide what 3161C means. What did Congress mean when it said the singular court in which the charge is pending? And we think that the text of 3161C and the context of the entire statute means the best reading is it's the court in which the charge is pending for trial. That would be consonant with the long established treatment of defendants who are arrested in another district. So if you're arrested in another district, the speedy trial clock does not commence until you arrive here in Kansas on the facts of this case. Both categories of defendants should be treated the same. There's no reason why a defendant who scuttles a Rule 20 proceeding should have the speedy trial clock commence when that other defendant didn't. The two categories of defendants should be treated the same. That's consistent with the text. It's consistent with the context, particularly subsection A, which like subsection C is directed at the court, the judicial officer that can set the case for trial, and it's consistent with statutory purpose. And the point of 3161C is to set a logical time for the commencement of the speedy trial clock. That logical time is when a district has obtained physical custody of the defendant. That interpretation, like we said, treats similarly situated defendants the same. It promotes efficient proceeding because a contrary interpretation, the defendant's interpretation, would lead the government to be less willing to approve Rule 20 transfers, even though Rule 20 transfers promote efficiency and benefit defendants. It benefits defendants.
Mr. Hansmeier's argument, all it says is, you know, when the defendant is physically in Missouri, the United States Attorney's Office in Kansas better start getting ready for trial. And if they want to have the defendant, if they want to talk to the defendant and his counsel, then they need to contact the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Marshal's Office to have him physically transported to Kansas, or get on a plane and go to Missouri and talk to him. This is the same as if the defendant is arraigned, pleads not guilty, and is charged in state court, say in St. Louis County, and he gets writted to St. Louis County after he is arraigned in the District of Kansas. Well, there's nothing about the Speedy Trial Act that would be told while he is physically in St. Louis to appear for an arraignment or a trial, even in St. Louis County on state charges. He gets writted back, but the Speedy Trial Act, as I understand it, would continue to operate unless there's an ends of justice continuance. Am I wrong about that?
I'm not sure if I followed all of the turns of that. I'm
just saying the fact that he's physically in another place, that happens all the time with pending state charges.
Your Honor, the speedy trial clock will not commence unless the District of Kansas had obtained physical custody. Now, if it had, and if there had then been a Rule 20 transfer, then we agree the speedy trial clock would have commenced. But there is a difference there. The District of Kansas would have had physical custody of the defendant. He would have gotten counsel for one. He would have gotten counsel for the Rule 20 proceeding. In this case, the defendant never had counsel in Kansas until he appeared in Kansas. And while a court could enter ends of justice findings in the Kansas court, it's a little odd for a court to be making decisions like that when there's an unrepresented defendant. It shows that it's an odd fit, and it shows that Congress, when this court has to make a decision about which singular court Congress meant in 3161C, the much better fit with the text, the context, and the purpose is the charging district, the Kansas court in this case. I also just wanted to mention that if the government is less willing to do Rule 20 transfers, that doesn't help defendants. Defendants benefit from the consolidation of charges. Here, the defendant would have gotten 420 months. He was offered a plea agreement of 420 months in Missouri to resolve all three districts' charges. He also had charges from Colorado. Instead, he got a total of 438 consecutive months because he went to two different districts. So it's efficient for the government. It's also a benefit for the defendant. And it also just leads to this less shuttling of defendants back and forth, which is both burdensome and, quite frankly, dangerous. So for all those reasons, we believe that 3161C is best interpreted in line with what three other courts of appeals have already held. So three courts of appeals have looked at this issue, showing it's not that rare, and have agreed with the district court. There's no reason this court should strike out on a different interpretation. If I could talk about the alternate ground for affirmance. We think that's properly before this court. This court treats arguments for affirming at the district court differently than arguments for reversing it. And it's been properly briefed. The defendant even was given 2,400 extra words in his reply brief to address the alternate argument. So it would be fair for this court to address it. The tolling provisions do apply here if the court needs to reach that issue. The question is whether the 110-day block of time from November 15th, 2018, the day the paper for the cases was transferred back to Kansas after the settled Rule 20 proceeding, and the date of the defendant's Missouri sentencing, whether that 110-day block of time is excludable.
And counsel, can I get you to address the waiver question first? Didn't the government specifically waive any reliance on 3161H when it filed its supplemental response to defendant's motion to dismiss?
Well, Your Honor, waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. The government made a mistake. The government did not say these tolling provisions applied and we're not relying on them. It says we have not identified an exception which applies to this case.
Isn't that a specific waiver? I mean, that presumes that the government has looked at the exclusions, doesn't it?
I think it was a mistake. I don't think it was intentional. But I think that the waiver and forfeiture principles operate different when it's the appellee. This court, when it's considering judicial estoppel, waiver, forfeiture, when it's the appellee, looks at things differently because there's a greater deference owed because of the relationship between the Court of Appeals and the district court. And there's greater deference to the district court's actual judgments and orders. And there's greater disruption in reversing a district court. So when this court decides whether to consider an issue that wasn't raised below and what happened in this case, it looks at, is it an issue of law? Is the factual record developed? And is it fair to the opposing party to consider the issue? We think that on all three grounds, this court can consider the tolling issue. But if the court is concerned, the district court did not resolve this. The district court did not say that the H1 provisions, the tolling provisions, did not apply. It said, I'm not reaching this issue because I don't need to, given my other interpretation. At the very least, this court should remand for the district court to consider the tolling provisions if it feels like it shouldn't decide it itself in the first instance. And I see my time is up.
Judge Seymour, do you have any other questions?
No.
Judge Phillips, do you?
Well, thank you.
Okay. Karen, okay, you do. Mr. Hansmeier, you're recognized for your rebuttal.
All right, let me try to make 4 points. First, again, just to reiterate, Kansas is not the only court that can try this case. The venue can be waived. The parties could have waived venue. The case can be tried in Missouri. Second, this idea that he would be unrepresented in Kansas is untrue. As soon as that motion is filed to return the case to Kansas, it becomes a Kansas case. He's going to have an attorney in Kansas that is going to be able to represent him. Three, on this idea that there's this uniform authority in the Court of Appeals, it's not true. Read the cases. We don't think Young, Wickham, or Sutton were wrongly decided. They were correctly decided for a number of reasons. None of the cases involved this situation. Wickham was 3161I and an artificial indictment date that re-triggered the 3161C clock. Sutton involves a Rule 5C3 issue under Sixth Circuit precedent. Because the guy didn't plead not guilty in the transfer district, it becomes essentially a Rule 5C3, no speedy indictment, no triggering date there. Young is just a mess, to be honest with you. The thing to know about Young is the defendant never pleaded not guilty in Michigan. He never did it. And the prefatory clause of 3161C1 is in any case in which a defendant, a not guilty plea is entered. I mean, that case does not resolve this case. To the extent that there's unreasoned dicta in any of this, it's not persuasive. Ignore it. Last thing, I got 25 seconds. Seven reasons why the government waived the claim. It's classic, this alternate claim. It's classic waiver. The government acknowledged the claim below and expressly waived it. Inadequate briefing. The government doesn't brief waiver principles. Inadequate briefing. Failure to invoke plain error. There was no reason that wouldn't apply here. Inadequate briefing. No briefing on the three-step affirm on any ground test. The government should have done that. If I can get these last three points out. No abuse of discretion. The district court did not abuse its discretion in accepting the government's waiver below, and this court, quote, cannot invoke an alternative basis to infirm unless we can say as a matter of law that it would have been an abuse of discretion for the trial court to rule otherwise. Can I get these last two points out?
If you go as quickly as you just did.
Okay, inadequate briefing. The government doesn't explain how any delay resulted from the sentencing proceedings in Missouri. I mean, that's required under the statute. And this is an issue of first impression. The government doesn't cite any 10th Circuit precedent. It would be improper to rule on such an issue under such circumstances. Thanks for the extra 35 seconds.
All right, you're welcome. And out of fairness, Ms. Rao, I'm going to give you an extra 35 seconds if you want it.
I will rest on our brief unless the court has any questions.
Okay, thank you. It's very well submitted, very well presented, both in your written and oral submissions. Thank you both, counsel. This matter will be submitted.